The Islander, My Life in Music and Beyond, is the autobiography of fabled music producer Chris Blackwell, who's discovered and worked with some of the most important musicians of the second half of the 20th century. Everybody from Steve Winwood to Cat Stevens to Bob Marley to Grace Jones. As he turns 85, Blackwell takes us back to the island where it all began, Jamaica. Delighted to be welcoming onto the show the man who put it all down for, I put it in order for Chris Blackwell, Paul Morley. Paul, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Hi.
Thanks for joining us today. I mean, the Island Records has been a champion of undiscovered music, you could say. It's broken some fantastic artists, and you could argue that it gave us the world's first third world superstar and brought reggae to a world audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was founded in the late 1950s in Jamaica, where Chris Blackwell was looking for something to do, in a way, and stumbled into making music, making records. He ran some jukeboxes in Jamaica, which gave him an insight into the kind of music that people liked, formed a label in Jamaica. And in a way, you know, as a different type of acts he signed along the way, but he never lost his love for Jamaica, and always had his eye on introducing to the whole world a Jamaican artist, and that it wasn't just Nice music, which eventually became Bob Marley. But of course, before Bob Marley, he'd set up an extraordinary label that began launching Millie Small, a Jamaican act. So his first hit is a Jamaican act. And then slowly moves into British rock and becomes the most interesting maverick label, leading to Bob Marley. So it's an extraordinary story, and Chris has been wanting to tell it for some while, and I was lucky enough to be the guy he rang when he decided that he was going to do it.
And I mean, if we think now of record corporations as sort of faceless companies, you know, all only interested in the sort of profit sheet, but Island's always had that sort of different attitude and a different vibe to it.
It emerged at a time when the rules were still being made up about what a record label was, you know, the late 50s, early 60s. There were no clear templates. There was no corporate overseeing of something. It was still run by mavericks and iconoclasts. And some of the great figures in the record industry from that period, you know, like Chris and people like Andrew Lou Goldham and Brian Epstein of the Stones and the Beatles and all the people that started to manage certain acts like Chris did, They were interested in energy and the outsider nature of the music rather than necessarily just having hits. In fact, if they wanted to have hits, it wasn't necessarily because they wanted to make money. It was as much to make an impact and make a noise and to be allowed to carry on making music and making records. And so it's a period of time in popular culture that sort of, for one reason or another, come to an end. And Chris was a quiet figure, but he was definitely one of the great symbols of that era of pop and rock when the rules were being established, really. And he was also a great record producer, which I think gave him a different approach to running a record label, much more with the sensibility of an artist as much as a straightforward entrepreneur.
If you think about the groundbreaking stuff, I mean, I know that people may say that My Boy Lollipop is a bit of a throwaway doo-wop tune, but I believe it's the first time that a black female had been at number one in the UK.
A complete anomaly in a way, futuristic almost in the extreme, because the idea of having breaking through in a very white world with a black record that sounded very black, it sounded very Jamaican. I had the great Jamaican guitarist Ernest Ranglin, who helped invent ska music, sort of arranging the music and playing guitar, and a young black female singer that, you know, now we would take this much more for granted, or at least accept that's what should be happening. But back then, this was very unusual, and that came out of his instincts, really, of what he wanted to do. He wanted to set up things that were popular, but that were different. And his appetite for sharing Jamaican music with the world was instant with the fact that his first hit was Millie, and then of course Millie. You know, he has a hit with Millie and other people start ringing him, and suddenly he's being invited to pubs and clubs to see other acts, and he stumbles across Steve Winwood, which gives him the Spencer Davis Group and then Traffic. So it's like this wonderful sort of tour that Chris Blackwell takes through popular culture along the way, coming across the most interesting artists and finding a very particular way to make them work and encourage them and find different ways to both record them and market them.
Because, I mean, he's got the musician's sensibility. Do you think, he could spot in, the young Winwood, but this was a guy who was going to go very far indeed? And people forget, what a huge band Traffic were.
Yes, I mean, Traffic helped Chris move away from, for a moment, for a few years, the Jamaican music into a different kind of label where he would be signing acts like John Martin and Nick Drake and Fairport Convention with Joe Boyd, one of his sort of collaborators. He always had great collaborators. And with another great collaborator, Guy Stevens, he's working with Spooky Tooth and Mott the Hoople and Free. Always looking for the unusual, the things that more conventional record companies weren't necessarily kind of finding. He always liked to find something that had either been rejected or hadn't even been discovered. His instincts were always to the unconventional that would eventually be incredibly popular.
And if you think about sort of the wide church, if you like, because you've got, British folk, you've got John Martin yeah. on one hand, and I've got Solid Air in the car at the moment, truly, because it's one of, I listened to that in the 80s, it was one of my introductions to the stuff. And then you've got Nick, who is completely the other end of the scale. I mean, you think they were just gone for, okay, let's have, that folk singer. And then you've got,
yes.
And then you've got Cat Stevens again.
Exactly, yes. I think what's also interesting, especially with Nick Drake and John Martin, was the idea that Chris never panicked if things didn't necessarily sell immediately. He had a much more sort of long-term view. Eventually they would sell, he was sure. Eventually they would become known. Of course they were. And then sometimes, his gambles, if you like, and Cat Stevens was a kind of gamble, would pay off more instantly. But if they paid off instantly, he relished it. If they didn't, he wasn't sort of panicking like Nick Drake and John Martin, and you eventually people would discover and find out. And sometimes, even if he turned down things as he often did, like an Elton John or a Pink Floyd or a Whiter Shade of Pale, he still didn't panic. He was, in a way, his instincts were those of a gambler. And sometimes it would pay off and he would win in inverted commas, and other times he would lose, but he kept moving and tried again, and it was part of his sensibility, if you like, and led to the fact that he would come across Grace Jones, the B-52s, and then eventually U2. I think it was his sort of patient attitude, his non-corporate attitude, that ultimately led to him signing, as you say, some of the most important acts in that wonderful period of popular culture between, the 50s and the late 20th century.
If you think about a world where if in Spotify or jazz streaming, if they're not hooked in the first 30 seconds, it doesn't count kind of thing. And yet we have a guy who can put time and looks at it as an investment. Is it true that also we almost didn't get All Right Now, which is any pub you go to, there'll be a bad rock band playing that?
Well, I was speaking to Chris Ono the other day, and to this day he still talks about how he's not quite satisfied with that record. He was in the studio urging it on. He encouraged Free to make it a single when they weren't sure. And yes, for Free, they panicked when Chris said it was going to be a single because, they were uncompromising young blues musicians, and they didn't really want to go on Top of the Pops because bands like Led Zeppelin didn't, and they thought it was a sellout. But Chris was convinced, oddly enough, because of his Jamaican experience, he was very keen on those first 10, 20 seconds because he had experience in the jukeboxes. So he knew, as he did with Millie, that within the first 10 seconds, if you grab people, you had them. And he knew with All Right Now that was definitely a single. But to this day, he still grumbles a little bit that he didn't quite perfect it, even though it's become one of those iconic records.
Something that changed, the way we look at music and the way that music geography is defined and put Jamaica on the map is Bob Marley. Yes. People listen to Marley who weren't even born, who were born long before he passed away. What was different about Marley and what was the relationship? Because I remember the press when he came to do those shows, was it the Rainbow?
Yes.
And absolutely blew everybody out of the water.
Yes. Well, Chris, because of his determination to break Jamaican music worldwide, originally he thought it was going to be Jimmy Cliff, but he there was sort of some frustration from Jimmy Cliff that he couldn't quite get it done quick enough. So he left, and then almost a day or two after he left Ireland, Bob Marley and the Wailers walked through the door into Chris's office. And Chris had this sort of idea that one way to distribute more widely Jamaican reggae music was to treat it as if it kind of was rock music. Package it that way, produce it that way even. Some people suggested it might be a compromise, but Chris thought that by adding certain keyboards that a rock audience was used to, a certain kind of guitar playing, that the rock audience was used to. It wouldn't pasteurize or dilute the power of reggae music. It would simply mean that more people were likely to hear it. And Bob Marley was very keen on that idea. Bob Marley was very appreciative how Jamaican music had always been a hybrid of different sorts of music. So the Bob Marley leapt on it with relish, unlike the other two Wailers, the idea that Chris wanted to take this further. And he understood because of the acts Chris had been involved in, whether that was Traffic or Roxy Music or John Martin, that Chris wasn't the kind of guy that was, you know, going to cause him to sell out. He was still interested in making mesmerizing, bewitching music. And Bob and Chris had this amazing relationship, which I was so pleased to explore at length in the book, that meant that Chris's dream of an international Jamaican superstar came true. And it was largely due to the dynamic nature of the relationship between Chris and Bob.
And I mean, basically, he sold it to a white audience who'd never, you know, they didn't know that music, or if they did, it was maybe a bit of ska or something like that, and they thought it was, you know, very heavy on the dub, very heavy on the bass, and yet, you know, Marley becomes this massive superstar. You know, he's in the pop charts.
Well, because he could write, yeah, great melodic sense as much as anything else. So as militant as his songs could sometimes be, they're incredibly powerful pop songs. And also, you know, Chris gave them access, Bob Marley access to great musicians, great studios, encouraged Bob Marley to think big, to think wider. And it makes a difference. It gives him a kind of confidence. And then, you know, in turbulent times, you know, an artist like Bob Marley becomes very important. But he's also appealing to a wider audience. And slowly, although it was a lot slower than people might think now, he becomes the iconic artist that we think of today. But it is definitely Chris's experience with Island Records in the 60s and early 70s before he met Bob Marley, oddly enough, the techniques he picks up working with white English acts that he introduced to Bob Marley that makes Bob Marley what he is. So Chris has got both a Jamaican experience and a more British experience from the late 60s and early 70s, progressive rock and folk, that helps Bob Marley, you know, appeal to a wider audience.
But also, I mean, doing business in Jamaica, extremely dangerous in the 70s. I mean, political upheaval, you know, shootings, etc. Marley was, as the saying goes, a prophet and a poet. I mean, he brought together, the islands in a way that the others couldn't do, but it must have been quite sort of touch and go at times.
You're taking real risks, and he had to be exiled after the shooting and come to London. But what's interesting, when he comes to London, 77, 78, it's in the middle of punk, and Bob Marley, with his open mind and his open ears, you know, responds to the energy that's coming from bands like The Clash and even the Sex Pistols, and introduces that into his music. You know, he was constantly absorbing influences in a way that ran parallel with the way that Chris Blackwell liked to mix things up. You know, when Chris Blackwell started to work with Grace Jones, he was mixing up different things to create a sound for Grace Jones. And Bob Marley, you know, was inspired by the way that Chris worked and was given a certain kind of freedom by the record label, therefore Chris, that he wouldn't have had anywhere else, to enable him to come up with songs that responded to the turbulent times, but also gave us some great, you know, positive songs of hope.
Let's move on to Grace, because we hadn't seen anything like it. And there are three albums in the 80s and some imagery that is, people use the word too often, but it is iconic. How did Grace come across his radar?
Well, Chris always liked recording studios. You know, he liked spaces and buildings and offices. He's always talking about, you know, Island Records offices, the recording studios he started so that Island could make records. And in the late 70s, you know, he initially wanted to take a recording studio, open a recording studio in Jamaica, but because of the political chaos, he opened it in the Bahamas instead, in Nassau and Compass Point. And what he wanted for Compass Point was very much a sound in the way that his favorite studios, the Tamla Studios or the Stack Studios, always had a sound. And Grace Jones gave him the opportunity to create a Compass Point sound by putting Sly and Robbie's reggae rhythms with European synthesizers and a rock sort of element. He put together a sound for Grace Jones, so he created a Grace Jones group that was also the sound of Compass Point. And that was sort of the element of Chris very discreetly acting like an artist. He's not a musician. He keeps saying it. He's not that kind of being. He's not even a technical kind of guy. But as a producer, his ability to put one thing with another and imagine what Grace Jones should sound like and then make it happen is, I think, part of his brilliance and why Island Records was so significant. He did the same with B-52s. He recorded them as well as a producer and imagined the sound that the B-52s should have and made it happen and at his best as a producer. And at his best as a producer, it was definitely represented by those three Grace Jones albums. You know, even just if he produced the music he produced, let alone what he did with Island Records, he would be a significant figure.
And then he takes it completely away from, you know, Sly and Robbie, you know, that, you know, Jamaican thing, and he just happens to discover U2. Is this just literally one of those, he walks into a pub and there they are?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, and at first he wasn't so sure, and oddly enough, his first instinct in the early 80s was that he fancied Spandau Ballet.
Fair enough.
But what he'd done, he set up such a great team of people at Island Records, and they were badgering him with the idea of U2. And then eventually he goes to see them, oddly on the day that he'd just seen Bob Marley play his last show in London before he died. So there's this weird overlapping nature of the acts he has. You know, Cat Stevens leads to Bob Marley, leads to Grace and U2 and Tom Waits. And he's not particularly struck by U2's music because as a jazzer, as a Jamaican, he thought it was a bit lacking in the bass end, in the rhythm section. But he meets them and he likes what he sees when he meets them. And he's very good at having those kind of instincts, Chris. And he liked the idea that very early on they were always already, even in playing in front of 10 people, acting like superstars. And I think it's the ability to sort of see ahead what's going to happen. And the confidence of the group, and the confidence of Bono, and the fact even that Paul McGuinness, the manager, wore a suit and tie and looked like he meant business. This is almost more important to Chris necessarily than the music, which he feels will take care of itself, you know. And it's another sign of how Chris Blackwell works, both as a gambler and as someone who has an instinctive understanding of what will be successful, not necessarily because of those early records or the demo tapes, but a different kind of sensibility that he senses.
And of course, they go on to be, you know, the world's biggest group during the 80s because they get lampooned by everybody who's coming across. This book also looks, though, at the Jamaica that he grew up in. And it's a fascinating sort of Ian Fleming, Goldeneye, cocktail, you know, rum punch at five sort of lifestyle, isn't it?
Well, he's in Jamaica in the 1950s when the Hollywood set are sort of inventing the idea of the boutique holiday, you know, the exotic post-war escape into glamour and excitement, and it's sort of, you know, Errol Flynn especially is sort of helping invent that in Jamaica. And Chris Blackwell's mother is very close to Ian Fleming, very close to Errol Flynn, very close to Noel Coward, and Chris is growing up. They were like his unofficial mentors, and they help him in a way in the 60s and 70s. He tells great stories about Errol Flynn and how once you've hung out with Errol Flynn, and Errol Flynn once punched Chris for stealing one of his girlfriends. He points out that once you've dealt with Errol Flynn, there's no amount of rock and roll shenanigans in the 60s or 70s ever fazed Chris. He could always be really cool, you know, whether it was Ginger Baker or Grace Jones or Marianne Faithfull or Keith Moon, any of these, you know, tearaways. He'd spent time with Errol Flynn and nothing could outdo him on that. Nothing could faze him once he'd had that. So it gave him a weird kind of experience for what was to come.
What's it like when you sit down with Chris? I mean, and you know, take the notes, record. I mean, did you do it in Jamaica? Was it a lockdown project? I mean,
it was a lockdown project, and therefore, unfortunately, even though I signed the deal just before the pandemic, this meant that I didn't quite get those wonderful trips to Jamaica to sit on the beach with Chris. No, I was doing it on the phone from rainy London. Chris was on the beach in Jamaica, but I'd spent, you know, many years with Chris on and off. Talking about this book or the idea of a book and getting the stories down. And I always knew that it was an important story, an important document of a certain time that now doesn't exist anymore. And as soon as Chris sort of said, yeah, let's do it, which in a way was a pandemic thing. He's always looking for projects, and then suddenly a book's a good pandemic project. Once he said, let's do it, you know, I was ready to go, you know.
So, I mean, the book, he's put, what is he, 84, 85 now, Chris?
85, yeah, just about to be 85,
so
yeah.
He's looking back at his career thus far. He must feel the incredible sort of pride and, you know, as he sits there on the beach, you know, watching the Caribbean Sea sort of waft, you know, come across the beach. He must feel, you know, incredible pride in what he does, because Ireland is just one of the most sort of eclectic record companies as there's ever been.
I think Chris was always sort of reluctant in a way to take the credit and stand into the limelight. There's very few pictures of Chris, for example, with Bob Marley. He always felt that it was important for him to be behind the scenes so he didn't get in the way. But I think now that history is being told about this time and those times, I think he realized that he needed to come out a little bit from behind the scenes and just sort of say, yeah, I was there when this happened and I helped some of it happen. And I think he's enjoyed, you know, the idea that now it's been turned into a book, because it sort of, you know, makes it very clear that this eclectic sort of series of great artists and musicians and visionaries, there was one thing that sort of they all had in common, whether it was, you know, Millie or Traffic or Roxy Music or Tom Waits, and it was Chris Blackwell. Chris Blackwell was there, always moving through, giving these artists the space and time to become what they became.
I will always be thinking about Spandau Ballet now as an Ireland record act. That could have been quite something.
Yeah, Chris is always the first to admit he would sometimes make a few mistakes, but out of the mistakes came the successes, you know.
Absolutely. The book is called The Islander, My Life in Music and Beyond. It is the autobiography of Chris Blackwell, who and Paul Morley was the lucky guy to have to put it all down. Paul, if people want to find you on the internet, where can they find you?
Yeah, they'll have to look a little bit, but sometimes if you just type your name in, you appear, so they'll find me somewhere.
Well, the book is called The Islander, My Life in Music and Beyond. It will be available as a virtual download. Paul, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks very much.